Welcome to Beyond Journal Club, a collaboration between CoreIM and NEJM Group.
The goal of Beyond Journal Club is to take landmark clinical trials and put them into context, telling the story of how we got to where we are and what it means for how we take care of our patients.
I'm Dr. Greg Katz, a cardiologist at NYU.
I'm Dr. Shreya Trivedi, internist at BIDMC.
And I'm Dr. Herlene Marwa, an editorial fellow at the New England Journal of Medicine and a pediatrician in Boston.
Wait a minute, Herlene. Let me just hype you up for a second and not hopefully embarrass you, but you carry a few other hats with that.
Thanks. Yeah. So I also have a background in climate change and health, including some work with the United Nations and the White House.
Yeah, just like slip that in there.
kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, guys. And maybe thematically, I'm really excited because today we're going to be talking about something I care a lot about, microplastics. And we're going to be looking at the APACHE study, or the pollutants in atherosclerotic plaque or cardiovascular events. The study explored the association between microplastics and cardiovascular outcomes, and it was published in the March 6, 2024 issue of NEJM.
This study raised a ton of questions about big picture things like how can we use observational data to identify important associations that may cause disease? And this microplastic question is everywhere, from the New York Times to the Atlantic to even my friends' group chats that are becoming infiltrated with questions about plastic-free underwear.
Greg, is plastic in underwear? Should I be worrying about like the underwear I'm buying for my boys?
Maybe. I mean, this stuff hits home not just with our clothing choices, but also about like mundane daily questions. Like, do I need to feel guilty about buying a bottle of water for my kids?
Totally. As a pediatrician, I've seen so many parents questioning, is it worth it to switch to glass baby bottles that they then need to spend 30 minutes washing? These questions on plastics do hit really close to home when it comes to your own family and your own children.
Yeah. So yeah, to get into all of that, we're going to start with the story of what has and has not been the case for microplastics in human health.
Then we'll examine the APACHE study, which is actually the first observational study we've had on the show.
And finally, we'll discuss the implications here and try to answer the question of whether we should be asking our patients in clinic about their plastic exposure.
Or underwear exposure. Ugh.
So to start off, let's discuss the key players in the plastic world and what we know about micro and nanoplastics.
We were really excited because we got to speak about this with Dr. Phil Landrigan. He's a pediatrician, epidemiologist, and he's a real leader in the plastic health space.
And I just want to emphasize what a big deal Dr. Landrigan is and how much gravitas his words carry. He is a giant in the field of environmental harms to health, who has decades of experience and a track record for advocating for important societal change.
Well, maybe the way to contextualize this is to begin by talking briefly about what plastic is. So 99% of all the plastic on the market today is made from fossil fuels, from gas, from oil, or from coal. And all plastic, any plastic whatsoever, has two main components. Firstly, it has a polymer backbone, a polymer matrix. It could be polyvinyl chloride, polystyrene, polyethylene, polyurethane, and so on, consisting of multiple repeating elements, small carbon molecules that are joined by carbon-carbon bonds. So that's every plastic has that as its backbone. And then manufacturers insert thousands of different chemicals into the polymer to give the polymer particular properties. They can put in dyes to give it color. They can put in heavy metals like lead in some instances to give it stability. They can add phthalates, which are called plasticizers, to give the plastic flexibility. For example, polyvinyl chloride by itself is very rigid. Think of a PVC pipe. But if you put phthalates into polyvinyl chloride, it makes the PVC flexible. Think of a rubber ducky.
So you may see plastic show up differently on labels. You might see it labeled as polyvinyl chloride or PVC.
Yeah, think about like materials we use for food wrap, bottles, even drain pipes.
Or polyethylene.
Think about materials we use in plastic bags.
Or Teflon.
Think about material that we use for nonstick pots and pans.
And since plastic is not biodegradable, it doesn't ever get broken down by microorganisms and recycled back into the environment.
And that's no bueno, right? Because instead of these plastics going back into the environment, those polymers just break down into smaller and smaller pieces. They turn into microplastics or nanoplastics. And just to be precise, microplastics are smaller than 5 millimeters, about 0.2 inch, and nanoplastics are even smaller, right? Smaller than 1,000 nanometers.
Very small. Thank you so much for the precision.
Yeah.
And even though it is more precise to use the terms microplastics and nanoplastics, and a lot of these studies did look at both, we're going to use the more colloquial term microplastics to cover both terms for the remainder of the episode.
Just rolls off the tongue easier.
Yeah. And these microplastics are everywhere. Their tiny size means they can travel through air, water, or even food.
Yeah. You know, before this episode, I could understand microplastics getting into our body with ingesting foods that were around plastic or wrapped in plastic, but I didn't know that microplastics could actually get into our body with inhalation or even skin exposure, hence the whole underwear question.
Yeah, totally. And I even read some studies that have shown microplastics found in different sizes in the liver, the lungs, urine, blood, placenta, even breast milk.
Wow.
And there's in vitro data showing that microplastics cause oxidative stress, disrupt cell membranes, and activate inflammatory cascades. And then you add in vivo data with rats and mice showing that treatment with high levels of microplastics leads to a prothrombotic state.
And then what we get most concerned about is microplastics have been linked to actual human health outcomes.
The first indication that plastics might have implications for human health was a report in JAMA around 1972 of 4 cases of angiosarcoma of the liver, a very rare cancer, in a small group of chemical workers at a PVC polymerization plant in Louisville, Kentucky. And I was working for CDC at that time, and I got involved in that investigation. And although we didn't put all the pieces together at that point, we didn't really realize that microplastics in the ocean and angiosarcoma of the liver in Kentucky were somehow connected. It's now clear that those are 2 pieces of a puzzle.
So it is so easy to start getting alarmed when you dive into this stuff. You read a review article here on microplastics being found in various human tissues, a mechanistic study there showing that microplastics can induce oxidative stress. And it is so easy to think that we have found a smoking gun. But that is not the way the science works here. Building up that chain of causality through high quality research takes an enormous amount of work.
Exactly. And when I was digging into the background research, the thing that I kept coming back to was just how different all of these studies are. As we said earlier, there's dozens of microplastics. They all have different sizes, different chemical compositions, and different biologic effects.
So it's easy to throw around the term microplastics, but when you actually get into the research, you realize there's multiple layers and nuances to the topic.
And that makes it even more complex to study. You can't just do a trial where you inject people with microplastics versus placebo and then watch them in a bubble for 3 decades to see who gets sick from heart disease or cancer.
Exactly. And even though that would answer the question, that experiment to prove causation is impractical and unethical. So we're left with trying to build that case for causality on the microplastic question by examining in vitro experiments, epidemiologic links, and animal studies, all of which are totally heterogeneous.
Yep. So let's look at one method of figuring out whether an epidemiological relationship is just correlation or actually causative.
So how can we recognize if the likelihood that an epidemiologic association is actually causative? Well, one of the most widely appreciated methods is the Bradford Hill criteria.
This criteria is named after Sir Austin Bradford Hill because he was the one who built the evidence connecting cigarette smoking with lung cancer.
And we'll link the full review of the Bradford Hill criteria in the show notes. But just to give you some context, the criteria includes things like the strength of the association. Is there a biological plausibility? Is there a temporal relationship? Is there a presence of a dose-response relationship? Is there consistency across data sources? And even some experimental data is helpful.
And the good news for the Apache study, but the bad news for our dishwashers, is that work done thus far on microplastics ticks quite a few of the boxes on the Bradford Hill criteria to link microplastics to cardiovascular disease. But by no means is it a slam dunk.
Okay, so for this criteria on biologic plausibility, we have this in vitro data linking microplastics to oxidative stress and inflammation, both of which are part of the pathophysiology of atherosclerosis.
And then there's also that experimental data from animal studies that we just mentioned a minute or two ago.
And there's the way that so many lines of research are converging on concern about microplastic exposure that certainly suggests consistency across data sources.
Okay, so with that, what are the gaps that make us hesitate before we can say, okay, this epidemiological association is actually causative? So what do we still not have in terms of data for the Bradford Hill criteria?
Well, to start, we don't have really any evidence describing a temporal relationship between exposure and disease. And I haven't been able to find anything about a dose-response relationship. Building the science here is just so complex. As the saying goes, the further out you go, the deeper the water gets.
And so I think it's safe to say that the relationship is hypothesized to be causative rather than proven to be so thus far. And this brings us to the Apache study. So what did the Apache investigators set out to study? One, whether microplastics are detectable within atherosclerotic plaque. And two, whether the presence of those microplastics is associated with adverse cardiovascular events.
So the investigators followed patients who were referred for surgery to remove carotid artery blockages, then examined what was in that plaque, and then followed what happened to those patients.
Yeah, and we sat down with Dr. Jane Leopold, a cardiologist and deputy editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, about the choice of looking at those carotid arteries.
And this is really kind of a unique opportunity because if you think about how we treat atherosclerosis in the coronary arteries, we don't remove them so that we can actually scrape out the atherosclerotic plaque. So we can't get tissue from there. In the peripheral vessels, surgeons bypass them, but they actually do not peel out the plaque. Really, the carotids are the one place where you can get human tissue to do this.
The investigators recruited patients with asymptomatic, extracranial, high-grade internal carotid artery stenosis. That means patients who had a greater than 70% blockage in their carotid arteries, but no prior history of stroke.
Yeah. And as you can guess, right, these patients were mostly men in their 70s, overweight, had high blood pressure. A third of them also had diabetes, dyslipidemia, or cardiovascular disease. What is surprising, though, is very few of them smoked.
Yeah. And here's where I thought the study got really interesting. They didn't randomize these patients to intervention or treatment. Everyone in the study was being surgically treated for their carotid disease. And then the researchers took those excised plaques and measured the quantity of 11 microplastics. Guys, they were quite literally looking for the presence of microplastics in atherosclerotic plaque.
Yeah, wild. And then they followed these patients to see what happened in a prospective manner in terms of their cardiovascular risk.
As with most cardiovascular disease studies, they looked at a composite outcome, including non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, or death from any cause among the patients with plaque-containing microplastics compared to patients who had plaque without microplastics in it.
Guys, the microplastic pictures in the paper are so fascinating. You can literally see plastic inside these plaques. I mean, fascinating, but also, oh my gosh, kind of scary too. Did anyone else feel that?
Totally. It was like a little game of I spy the plastics in plaque. Right. And so what did they find? So out of the 11 microplastics they looked for, they actually identified two microplastics, polyethylene and polyvinyl chloride.
Interesting. So how many of these patients undergoing carotid artery surgery had those microplastics?
So about half of those patients, or 150 of them, had detectable polyethylene in the plaque. And about 12%, or 31 of them, also had detectable polyvinyl chloride.
And so now onto the big news result. When they stratified patients with microplastics and those without it in their plaques and cardiovascular outcomes, what do they find?
So in those patients with plaque containing microplastics, the composite endpoint of non-fatal MI, non-fatal stroke, or death from any cause occurred in 20% of patients versus 7.5% in patients without microplastics.
Right. And then when they adjusted for other cardiovascular risks, they found that patients who had microplastics in their carotid plaques were 4.5-fold more likely to have a bad cardiovascular outcome.
It's an impressive hazard ratio. And The authors bring mechanistic explanations too. They found that higher levels of inflammatory cytokines like IL-6 and TNF-alpha were expressed in patients who had microplastics in their plaques compared to those who didn't.
Interesting. So Guys, I know like correlation doesn't equal causation. This is an observational study, but yeah, that 4.5 hazard ratio is pretty alarming.
It's very seldom that an epidemiologic study finds a relative risk as high as 4.5. Usually when we're talking about the risks of dietary factors, for example, or exercise, we're talking about 40% or 60% or 80% increased risks, not 450%. You only get those kind of big risks with cigarette smoking, with asbestos, with some nasty industrial chemicals. So I think it's a finding that has to be taken seriously, even though it certainly does not yet prove cause and effect. And other investigators need to be undertaking studies urgently to either confirm or refute the findings. I mean, it's always possible that some confounding factor having to do with diet or lifestyle or something else accounts for the findings that Marfella and his colleagues saw. But a 450% increase is a big risk, and it can't be wished away.
Yeah, certainly perks up my ears. So to summarize where we are so far, the APACHE study looked at patients with asymptomatic severe carotid stenosis. Some of the plaques had microplastics, and of those patients that had microplastic, they were more likely to have strokes, heart attacks, and death later.
Like one last thing we should get into before discussing what these findings actually mean. As someone who's a regular reader of the New England Journal of Medicine, it is pretty uncommon to see the journal publish an observational study, especially one that has such a small group of patients. So it was really interesting to me to hear Dr. Leopold talk about the rationale behind why the journal chose to publish this study.
The journal does not often publish observational data. And so what was really interesting about this particular study is there's been a lot of information forthcoming in about the hazards associated with plastics in general, and then micro-nanoplastics, and seeing these accumulate in different body tissues, bodily fluids, etc. But what this study showed that was really fascinating was that it was actually present in a vascular or cardiovascular disease state, and it was localized to the area of the disease. You have availability of human tissue to look at this association, and you have some sophisticated methodology to be able to identify the micro-nanoplastics. So for all of these reasons, this is why the journal went forward with this, really to shine a light on the idea that these micro-nanoplastics are accumulating at sites of cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, this is definitely worthwhile to shine a light, right? This is the first time researchers found evidence of microplastics in actual human atherosclerotic plaque and linked that finding to increased risk of cardiovascular events.
And that brings us to the most important part here. What can we conclude from this study, and what does this tell us about how we should be taking care of our patients?
The holidays are sneaking up fast, and I've got to say, I love Uncommon Goods. As the name suggests, it's full of one-of-a-kind gifts you won't find anywhere else. For example, I've definitely gotten stock keepers before on things to get my nieces or nephews. It feels like they have everything, right? But Uncommon Goods has things that are truly different, thoughtful, high-quality, handmade often, made right here in the U.S. And there's something for everyone, moms, dads, teens, foodies, aka all my cousins, even gardening stuff for my dad. So I found so many fun personal ideas I haven't seen before. And if you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're not just checking something off a list, you're also supporting artists, small independent businesses, and many of their products are made in small batches. So if something catches your eyes, definitely scoop it up before it sells out. And I love this. With every purchase, they donate $1 to any nonprofit partner of your choice. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/coream. That's uncommongoods.com/coream to get 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited offer. And as they say, Uncommon Goods, because we're all out of the ordinary. And now back to the episode.
So before we get into how these findings are directly impacting our patient care, I think it's helpful to dive into a couple of different questions that are upstream of that patient care question. The first is whether microplastics actually cause human disease.
And I think it's interesting to note that the authors of the APACHE study did have a cautious conclusion. They clearly stated in the discussion that, quote, it is important to note that our results do not prove causality.
And then there were other people who had a different spin, right? That's what happens with research, right? They felt that this study should compel us to really do something, right? For example, a cardiologist, Dr. Eric Topol, wrote that these findings, quote unquote, demand urgent attention.
And the editorial by Dr. Phil Landrigan, who you heard earlier, interpreted this data as a call to action, especially when we account for the fact that we don't just have plastic exposure, we have all of the additives in the plastic around us.
I have absolute confidence that micro and nanoplastic particles are getting into the human body. I have absolute confidence that a number of the chemicals that are in plastics, like phthalates, like bisphenol A, like brominated flame retardants, are damaging human health. I think there are abundant, high-quality epidemiologic studies, toxicologic studies, mechanistic studies that support those assertions. I think we still need to wait for more data before we can say with a high degree of confidence that microplastic particles per se cause cardiovascular disease or disease in other organs. I want to see some studies that either confirm or refute the Marfella study before I say it's a proven case of causality, but I'm highly suspicious.
There's so much complexity here. We don't know the added impact looking at all of the additives like phthalates and plastic around us. And with so many potential insults to our health, it feels almost impossible to know anything definitively.
Yeah, I mean, that brings up a question for me. They looked at 11 different plastics. Why was it that only polyethylene and polyvinyl chloride were detected, right? What is it about polyethylene and polyvinyl chloride that preferentially kind of accumulates in these plaques? You know, are they more pathogenic than the other microplastics? And also then, does that mean, do we avoid food wrapping, plastic bottles, somehow figure out how to avoid drain pipes?
Aside from the fact that it's impossible to avoid drain pipes, I also think it's hard to say anything definitive about this causality question. And I'm stuck on the fact that Apache, which showed the presence of microplastics in plaque, doesn't tell us anything about the exposure to plastics that these patients had.
Yeah, I mean, who were the 58% of patients who had plastics in their carotid arteries? And I think more importantly, who were the 41% of patients who didn't?
Yeah. So if you were somebody who had microplastics in your plaque, does that mean you drink your water from plastic bottles and get all your meals from takeout and use plastic utensils? Or on the flip side, does not having microplastics in your plaque mean that you use glass Tupperware, avoid plastic food wrapping, and always wear 100% cotton underwear?
Yeah, always coming back to that. And yeah, I mean, does it make a difference where your plastic exposure comes from? Inhalation, absorption, ingestion?
Yeah. And if we still have some major gaps to close, right? There's no real data nodding to a biologic gradient, right? For example, it would be nice if we saw that, hey, increased exposure to plastic really drives an increased cardiovascular risk.
Totally. And we also don't have temporality data that links exposure to plastics over time to outcomes. As a pediatrician, that's something I'm really interested in. If kids are having exposure, they're going to be exposed to it in theory over a longer period of time. And we know that plastics are already ubiquitous in the environment and that kids have a lot of other exposures as well. Everything from plastic baby bottles, like we talked about earlier, to even their toys. So what is that cumulative risk over time? And then how does that correlate to outcomes?
Such good questions. And I think this problem just feels honestly so overwhelming. Plastics are everywhere.
And to that end, we're assuming it may be the type of plastic playing a role, but what if it's actually something about the patient, like underlying inflammation, that's actually driving the risk?
Yeah, I come back to the question of, is it that sicker and more inflamed people are more likely to integrate plastics into their plaque? Or are these plastics the things that are actually causing the cardiovascular events?
I appreciate that point. You know, it's like going back to that, is it a chicken or egg kind of scenario here?
Yeah, but I do go back and forth a little bit about that underlying inflammation. One argument against microplastics being the causative driver of inflammation and atherosclerosis actually comes from the supplemental appendix of this study, where they looked at the amount of microplastics in these plaques and also the amount of inflammatory cytokines that patients expressed.
Yeah, it'd be nice to see a dose response, right? That, you know, the more microplastic in the plaque, the more inflammatory cytokines also in the plaque.
Yeah, but here's where things get a little bit more confusing, because the authors didn't really find a strong correlation between increased levels of microplastics and markers of inflammation in these patients.
Oh, man, I feel like the deeper we dive, just more and more questions surface.
I totally agree. And on that first question, Do microplastics cause human disease? I think I'm still not really there regarding plastics, particularly when it comes to cardiovascular disease, even after such compelling research like this study.
Yeah. So I guess, yeah, I'm curious, you know, where does this leave you with kind of what you are or are not bringing up to your patients?
So maybe even the bigger question to me when it comes to counseling patients is I don't think that we really understand what the exposure is. And so even if you assume that microplastics are causative in human disease, where are patients getting their exposure from? Is it from water bottles, from takeout containers, from their clothing? Does it matter if the plastic is heated or not?
Ah, good point. I always think about the heated or not heated question. It's so hard to know what to counsel on.
Yeah. And we still don't even really know if we can modify our plastic exposure in any appreciable way to change our risk. How much of the microplastics in our bodies are related to our cutting board or Tupperware choices versus just being exposed to the world and being alive in the year 2025? Is the plastic being found in our bodies coming from ambient exposure or from our conscious choices?
Yeah, such a fair question, right? Like, can our daily actions, if we change them, can it even make a dent, right? Can it actually even play a role in modifying disease risk? Or like you were saying, is it just constant exposure to plastics, you know, from PVC piping or plastic in our food, you know, underwear, gosh.
Wow, way to bring it back full circle. Yeah, I mean, it keeps coming back to that question. Yeah. I mean, on the exposure point, I've been wondering about how exposure to other things like air pollution, more specifically particulate matter in the environment, influence our risk too. How do things like diet, drinking water, even our bathing water sources influence exposure and outcomes? There really are countless unmeasured and confounding variables that we're definitely going to struggle to completely consider.
And so nobody's arguing here that we should be trying to get more plastics into our bodies. But I think that even if we assume that microplastics do cause human disease, I'm not sure it's worth the opportunity cost in a patient visit to talk about microplastics when that means limiting our time talking about things that I feel more confident cause cardiovascular disease. Harleen, have you been changing the way that you counsel your patients on this?
Yeah, I think it's a really tough question, and you bring up a good point that we do have limited time to talk with our patients. I think for me, after doing all the prep work for this podcast, I started making some changes in my own life. Like, I didn't feel comfortable using my plastic cutting board anymore without actively thinking about how I was adding more plastics mm-hmm. into my life. So since I'm making all these small changes, it made me start to think, how could I not counsel my patients on this? I think sometimes in science, we want to have absolute confidence about what we're telling our patients about. But even if we don't have absolute confidence that microplastics are the cause of human disease, I definitely think this has raised enough evidence for me to be concerned.
And so you're talking about it, even though your confidence in the causality is not 100%.
Yeah. And totally, I understand that there's a lot of questions about exposure and about, you know, how we design our clinic visits and anticipatory guidance and manage that time with our patients. I also get that for a lot of people, it can feel uncomfortable to take action before we have certainty. But I feel an obligation to help my patients minimize any potential harm by at least sharing where we're at with the science. You know, I think about the oath we all take to do no harm, and I wonder if I'm not sharing this information with them about how they could potentially modify their risk, do I end up doing more harm over time? I think sometimes we want to wait for certainty, but in health, the stakes are so high, and so are we just allowing harm to perpetuate while we wait?
Oh, so good. So good. I think what I'm hearing from both of you is that everyone has like a different personal threshold for making a change. And I think like this comes up all the time, right? When we think about like starting treatment on a patient, you know, some people need to be like very sure that a person has pneumonia before starting treatment. Some are okay being a little bit less sure. And I think the other thing I want to raise is that our patients are already getting this messaging. Anyone who's on social media, or maybe they're not even on social media, any like WhatsApp group, like there is some messaging around like change your spatulas to silicone, change this, change that. I mean, and maybe they don't know all the reasoning as to why. And then it's our job to fill in what do we actually know in terms of that connection to human health and what connections are not there yet.
Yeah. Totally agree, Shreya. I think for me, a couple of things is that my patients are children. And so the appetite for risk is usually small, both from my perspective, but also from the families and the parents taking care of the kids too. So oftentimes, I'm not even the one necessarily bringing it up. Families are coming to me with these questions. I think the other thing that kind of makes my perspective a little different as a pediatrician is that there's ample opportunity to integrate it into counseling I'm already doing. Like when we're talking about transitioning to table foods, when we're talking about weaning from bottles, there's these like opportunities for me to integrate it and not have to bring it up as something new. And, you know, when parents do ask me about it, I honestly explain where we're at with the science here and kind of exactly what you had just said. And I think for families, if they have the ability, access, and if they're interested in making these changes to reduce risk, then I encourage it because why not?
So when I talk to families, they get so many competing pressures. But I tell people that they do have agency. They do have the power to make change. And I talk about people's ability to make change. So firstly, acting as the CEOs in their own home, that they have power over what they purchase, what they bring into the home, and what they feed their children. And of course, you've got to be realistic here. Nobody's going to get away from plastic entirely in the year 2025. It's not possible. But you talk to people about at least reducing their exposure. Try to tell them not to stress out about it, which is sometimes easier said than done, I recognize. But try to say to folks, listen, do what you can, and your kids will probably grow up okay, but at least do what you can within your own home.
You know, I do sometimes wonder if we tell patients to do what they're able to do in terms of minimizing plastic exposure, I just keep thinking about the patients who just aren't able to, right? Mm-hmm. Making these changes, like, really inconvenient, time-consuming, and definitely more expensive in a world that already feels so, so expensive. I'm just so worried about worsening things from an equity perspective.
Yeah, that's totally a fair point, Shreya. And I appreciate that you're centering equity in this discussion. I think when we talked about that ubiquitous exposure to plastic earlier, we talked about things like water exposure, air pollution, all of those things. And we already know that the burden of those exposures is not shouldered equally. I really appreciated what Dr. Landrigan had to say about where we are already with the equity around plastics.
The current system of plastic manufacture. Clearly, any transition away from plastics, just like any transition away from fossil fuels, has to be carefully engineered to be just, to protect the rights of the most disadvantaged. I'm totally on board with that. But we have to recognize that the current system is profoundly unjust and inequitable, violates human rights at many stages, and the fact that the transition will be difficult is not an excuse for perpetuating the current state of affairs.
Mic drop. I just love that last line. The fact that this is difficult is not an excuse for perpetuating the current state of affairs. Ugh, so good. Needs to be printed, framed, hard cosign, attestation. Send to billing.
Yeah, totally agree.
All the good stuff.
Yeah, I think it is such an inspiring mantra, especially as we take on all these questions that we're left with. And we'd love to hear from all you listeners. How does this landmark observation study sit with you?
Yeah. And then the other questions are, should we be all taking a plastic exposure history? Is there time for that?
And does altering how we take in plastics make any dent in our cardiovascular risk when it feels like plastics are everywhere?
And with that daunting question, I just want to put on my advocacy hat and reiterate what Dr. Landrigan said. Just because it could be difficult, it's not an excuse for perpetuating the current state of affairs.
And that is a wrap for today. If you found this episode helpful, please share with your team and colleagues and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
And check out the behind the scenes YouTube video with Dr. Phil Landrigan. He got into so much more with plastics. It was just so fascinating to learn about the fossil fuel industry and where things have come from and where things may be going. We will link it in our show notes. Thank you to Dr. Jimin Wong for the accompanying graphic, as well as to Jerome Reyes for the audio editing.
And if you have any feedback, please email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com.
The opinions expressed here are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliated institution.
We'll link the full review of the Bradford Hilt. Why, it's such an easy word. Oh, so good. Needs to be printed, framed. Yes.
Yeah, fine. Totally agree.
What's that thing people say? Like cosine. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Can I just try that one more time?
Retweet.
Cosine. No, attestation.
Re-X. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I just want to test it because, you know, people have, I don't know, the world right now. All right.
I love that you're Phil Landrigan's attending.
So good.
The dream. All right.